Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Dave Itzkoff, who is the author of the New York Times bestselling book, Robin, Biography of Robin Williams, and Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies, which is what we're going to be discussing mostly today. Network, almost 50 years old. I think it turns 50 next year. Dave, thanks for being on the show today.
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me.
So I wanted to talk Network. It's funny, we had been kicking around doing a Bulwark Movie Club on the Network, and it kind of fell through for various reasons. But I read your book in preparation for it, and I was like, I'm not letting this preparation go to waste. I'm gonna get Dave, on the line, and we're gonna talk about Network, because
right.
Network remains kind of a eternally relevant movie. And we'll get to that in a minute, but I want to talk about the actual making of the movie and what you learned when you were researching it, because it is a fascinating story. You know, it's a view from the inside, not just of network news, not just of news journalism, whatever, but really television as a medium. It's this view of television as a medium that is told through the very dyspeptic lens of Paddy Chayefsky, who came up in TV. Tell us a little bit about Paddy and why he wanted to write this movie.
Sure. You know, and certainly, I mean, I say this with no disrespect whatsoever to Sidney Lumet, who is the director of Network and obviously, played a huge role in shaping it. But yes, it is centrally Paddy Chayefsky's film. In fact, if you watch the movie and you look at the opening credits, you will see that it says, like, after the title credit of Network, it says a Paddy Chayefsky film, which is very unusual, certainly in this day and age and even in the era that it was made in, for the screenwriter to get that kind of credit and not the director. But that's because Chayefsky was so, you know, instrumental, not only in writing it, but so hands-on in the filming of it, which in some ways made it very difficult for them to find a director when they wanted to make it. But as you say, Chayefsky started in television at the dawn of the medium, when there was no such thing as like genre yet. They didn't have sitcoms. They didn't have kind of established formats for shows. Chayefsky was kind of just getting started out as a dramatist and contributed a lot to anthology drama shows, where they would basically just get a different playwright each week to just write kind of like a one act or an hour long play that they would then film. And his big breakthrough was Marty, which started out as one of these anthology episode in an anthology show, and then was later made into the film with Ernest Borgnine, which won Best Picture, won Chayefsky his first Academy Award. And after that, he never really kind of looked back at television again, at least not in terms of a career. Just continued to write film screenplays and some Broadway plays, but still very much had his eye on the medium of television. And in a lot of ways, certainly as TV progressed over the next 20 years or so, as Chayefsky tended to be about a lot of things, got very disenchanted with television and what he saw happening there, felt like it was a much more fertile medium with much more potential when he was working in it, and saw it get much more kind of codified and, to his mind, stagnated and losing its potential. And by the 1970s, of course, he had made many other films, including just a few years earlier, another movie that won him an Oscar for screenwriting called The Hospital, that had starred George C. Scott. It's, to my mind, not as good as Network. But if you watch it, I mean, it's, of course, exceedingly well written, has lots of great monologues the way that Network does, and is almost kind of like a dry run for Network, because it's, even though, it's set in a hospital, the main character is a doctor and a surgeon, very frustrated. And it's kind of about bureaucracy and just how these complex organizations and operations basically just tend to screw everything and everyone up, and power gets concentrated in people's hands, people who have life and death decision-making power and can't implement it, or implement it for the wrong reasons. So after the success of The Hospital, you know, Chayefsky was on the hunt for other stories to write, screenplays to write. And for years, even before he made The Hospital, had kind of toyed with the idea of, you know, exploring the TV industry, something about maybe local news, which he had no experience or background in, got to know like a news producer down in Atlanta who kind of interested him, started kicking that idea around. But the idea evolved and evolved and eventually became the film that we know, which is about network television news, to the point that, you know, as he was finishing the screenplay, Chayefsky actually, because he had the kind of the aura and the just the reputation that he did in his day, visited with all of the three major network news broadcasters and got to see their operations. He, you know, had a kind of correspondence with Walter Cronkite, visited all the offices and met with the anchors to see what they were doing. But they only sort of suspected the kind of movie that he wanted to write, which is extremely acid, extremely satirical, certainly not kind to the news business, not kind to anything, really. And there was some fallout after the film's release in terms of some of these people who had helped Chayefsky get into their business feeling like he had burned them.
It is interesting because in your book, you note a couple of times where Chayefsky first is, you know, kind of brazenly saying, oh, this is, you know, the movie is what it is. It is. We live in these bad. But he was also he also then kind of started to walk it back. I feel like he was really taking the heat. And there's this there was this great line. I jotted it down, but it was. Let me see if I can find it here. To make a gag out of the news is disreputable and extremely destructive, you know, he wrote, which is okay. But also, you kind of did. Like, let's not beat around the bush here. You're taking the piss out of the whole thing.
Yeah. He certainly recognized in his day the way that the three network news broadcasts, the massive influence that they wielded at the time. And you still get traces of that certainly in the film. If somebody goes on the air on CBS or NBC or ABC and says, this is what's happening, this is the case, then the millions and millions of people who watch network news at the time believe that and accept it. And of course, he's, you know, to a certain extent, trading on like the kind of reputation that Cronkite had during the Vietnam War and the way that the networks, kind of helped, you know, convince the larger audience that the war was not succeeding. And so on the one hand, you know, like Chayefsky is saying that these institutions have great power. The networks and the corporations, the institutions behind them have massive power. But also, as you say, I mean, he's kind of trying to puncture them with a pin and trying to show us how they are kind of stand-ins for any other, you know, large bureaucratic organization in life, certainly for government, certainly for multinational entities. So, yes, you're right that he is kind of trying to have it both ways and to say, well, you know, these things are almost too big and too important to mock. And yet, yes, he is indisputably mocking them and the people, who run them and participate in them. In terms of his own writing process, it was so kind of organic. He revised and revised constantly. And so, you know, I think it's very possible that in his own mind, he didn't have these things entirely worked out even as he was writing. And then he starts to see how it's landing with audiences, realizing that in some ways, yes, he did hurt and offend people that he had respect for. And he didn't really kind of make those calculations as he was doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because, you know, I'm sure you've come across this. You know, when you write about people's work, sometimes they take it poorly. This is a thing that happens. This is a thing that critics occasionally have to deal with.
Yeah.
And this film is nothing if not a massive act of cultural criticism. It is a real kind of denunciation of the ways in which news in particular doesn't quite fit into the profit and loss model that was coming to define so much of life in the 70s. There's this line in the early going from Robert Duvall, who is, of course, he's the kind of face of this management company that has taken over the network, where he says the business of management is management,
yeah.
which is such a bizarre, almost circular line, but is a perfect kind of representation of the lack of interest any of these people had in things like the truth.
Yeah. Well, none of the sort of main characters come out unscathed, in the course of this, and you have all of these different sort of archetypes, whether it's, as you say, the Duvall character, who's kind of, the hatchet man and the management guy, or, certainly, Faye Dunaway as the kind of scripted TV producer who, wants to take over the news side, who is, completely, malicious and self-interested. And Peter Finch, obviously the once great news anchor, but, has kind of, obviously fallen on hard times, fallen to drinking, literally, going insane, in the course of the movie. And then our Max Schumacher character, who, again, another kind of, a once great, news producer who, just kind of feels like they're either he's kind of lost his, his sense of, just the what is valuable about the work that he once did, and is, basically willing to kind of like go in on the gag and say, yeah, let's just put this insane man on the air and let him rip, and consequences be damned.
You described Faye Dunaway's character, who she plays this kind of younger TV producer who comes in and shakes up the news program, brings it into the fold of entertainment. She wants to have a psychic on the show.
Right.
She has this Vox Populi segment where they talk to a computer. It's the fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
but you described her as malicious, which is interesting because I like malicious suggests a sort of intentionality. Like, she's really just kind of oblivious, and this is one of the things I think Max talks about kind of at the end, is she was raised by TV. She
yeah.
has she's feral.
Yeah.
She has no idea, really.
She doesn't, yeah, doing. I mean, on the one hand, she doesn't realize what the kind of fallout of her actions is going to be, but when you see the other kinds of shows that she's developing, I mean, there's a whole subplot devoted to her essentially creating reality TV and the idea of the mouse tongue hour, where they're going to literally follow around these left wing terrorists, this group of bank robbers and kidnappers, and just document what they do and give them an hour a week to commit a different crime. I mean, like, the audience can understand, we hear it, we see it in front of us, it's a little bit heavy-handed, compared to some of the other things that Chayefsky does in the film, but we get it. Like, we can see that these are not actions that are meant to be celebrated in any way, and that, like, yeah, this is obviously somebody who, has a lot of negative feeling and just a lot of disappointment with what he sees happening in, his former industry.
Yeah, yeah. The Chayefsky's own relationship to the 1970s is interesting as well, because
yeah.
he is, by the time the radical groups that are parodied in this film are, ascendant, he's in middle age. He's a middle-aged man. He's not a young man anymore. He's kind of out of touch with them. You mentioned in your book that he is basically indifferent to the nuances of, SDS versus the SLA. Like,
yeah.
it's all just it's all just kind of a jumble to him. But what's fascinating, and I did not know this until recently, until after I had seen One Battle After Another, actually, is that so One Battle After Another, you know, is Paul Thomas Anderson's movie, and it has a lot of the echoes of this kind of 1970s radical groups, because particularly at the beginning. And I had not realized that Paul Thomas Anderson showed Network to the cast and crew of Magnolia before making that film. And once you see that, a lot of the first half, or the first third in particular, of One Battle After Another kind of clicks into place. It's like, oh, I see where this is coming from.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, obviously Anderson's, you know, his tone is quite different, not nearly as strident, although, I mean, he's, you know, certainly been criticized as well for, you know, not really kind of, you know, grasping or, you know, being quite able to, you know, dramatize, you know, political radicals, or maybe, you know, satirizing them with kind of too broad a brush. But yeah, it's that idea of just this kind of massive, multifaceted narrative with lots of characters, lots of moving parts, everybody kind of having their own self-interest, maybe, you know, 30 or 35 characters with speaking roles that you, the viewer, are going to be asked to, you know, keep track of and know who's who and what their desire is. And then to some extent in Magnolia, that idea of television and how, you know, how television specifically, you know, drives people and motivates them.
Yeah. Yeah. And Chayefsky, of course, was also very interested in the Arab-Israeli conflict. This is a kind of running theme throughout out the film. It's so funny. It's so funny watching this, because you don't often hear a lot of chatter about OPEC and oil prices in movies, but you do kind of from this time. But it really, what it called to mind more than anything else was the kind of for lack of a better word, the kind of yellow peril theme of a lot of 1980s thrillers, you know, that you even see pop up in like Die Hard, where Nakatomi Plaza is, you know, being taken over by the Japanese, which is just kind of a fascinating little tidbit.
Yeah.
You write a little bit about Chayefsky's relationship to all this in the book. How did that kind of inform his view of the world in this film?
Yeah, it's so interesting, because needless to say, he did not live in an era of, you know, 24-hour cable TV or the internet, where, you know, there's just, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people broadcasting all the time and every flavor of kind of, you know, conspiracy and paranoia at your fingertips. He watched the network news, he read all the major daily newspapers. And yet, in a way, I think that was like just enough to kind of drive him off the deep end, in the sense that he was, you know, very perceptive, quite neurotic, and, you know, just the kind of person that, you know, could, you know, he was hyper aware of what was happening throughout the world, but saw all these potential conflicts and hot spots, you know, and his personal politics are very hard to kind of pin down. I mean, Network is a movie that gets claimed often by both the left and the right. And he was not sort of easily categorized that way. He was a World War II veteran. He wrote, you know, in his archives, I found a lot of like letters that he wrote to the Nixon administration. I don't know how much correspondence he got back, but also, you know, he was like a supporter and a fan of Jimmy Carter when he got elected. And he, Chayefsky was also a Zionist, and also, you know, wrote like a whole screenplay in between The Hospital and Network that never got produced. That was about the Dead Sea Scrolls and, you know, set in the Palestinian Mandate right before Israel became a state. So all these things are like on his mind, you know, just perpetually. And I think, you know, he is just sort of waiting for that one, you know, flame to light the whole tinderbox and for the world to just kind of, you know, fall to ashes. He just seems to think that this can happen at any moment. And I think there's a lot of analogs, a lot of people in the present day who probably feel the same way, who have way more information at their fingertips than he did.
Yeah, it is interesting to think about how relevant this movie remains, despite the fact that the information ecosystem has changed so radically. I mean, not just the rise of cable news, but the rise of the podcast industrial complex, the rise of YouTube, you know, the people doing their own research. We got researchers out there everywhere, looking into these things. So, I mean, it is fascinating. One of the things that jumped out when I was reading your book is that the most famous moment in the film is the "Mad as Hell, Not Going to Take It Anymore" speech, right? He Howard Beale goes to his TV show. He's soaking wet. He's walked through the rain. He delivers this rip roaring monologue about how things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad, and he doesn't have any solutions. He's not going to tell you to contact your congressman because he wouldn't know what to say. He just wants people to go to their windows and yell, "I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore." And this becomes a rallying cry for the film. Bumper stickers are made for it.
It
is the line everyone quotes. By the end of the film, the audience in the newsroom is chanting it back at him. And in the real world, if there's one line people remember from the movie, it's this one. But it was interesting to read the description of the screenplay in your book, because the word that Chayefsky uses is Nuremberg.
The
producer goes to his window and he hears people shouting like it's a Nuremberg rally. And it's one of these interesting kind of disjunctions between what maybe was intended and what kind of came across to the rest of the audience, because everybody watching that movie is like, I am mad as hell.
I
am. You know what? Things are bad. Yeah. A dollar does buy a nickel's worth these days. This is not ideal. And yet it was not meant to be, I don't think, valedictory in the film, right? Like
it's supposed to be more sort of terrifying. And the fact that there, at least as this is happening in New York, you know, this kind of rainstorm happening and, you know, the shouting kind of, you know, synchronizing with, you know, thunder and lightning. And, you know, it's the unleashing of, you know, first of all, this one man's anger and literal insanity, and how, you know, the medium of television is propagating that, amplifying it, you know, instilling that in the viewers. That's clearly not supposed to be, you know, a good thing in the sort of the realm of the film, and that these people are just kind of almost mindlessly you know, following along or doing it in a kind of automatic way without really processing it or thinking about it. This is not something that the film is supposed to be celebrating. And I think it did, you know, kind of mystify Chayefsky following the film's release, that, as you say, it became the kind of the emblem of the movie, this catchphrase, and the one thing that people, you know, to this day, most associate the film with. It was not, from his standpoint, a kind of, you know, heroic or celebratory moment.
Which I guess leads me to my next and maybe biggest question, which is that the problem is the corporatization of news, kind of. The real problem is the audience. the real problem out there is the audience, because the audience doesn't want news. The audience wants entertainment. The audience wants something other than what is, you know, the actual factual truth. And I don't think anyone has come up with a particularly good solution for this.
Yeah. I mean, I think the film is kind of saying that the problem is everyone and everywhere, and there's no one person, you know, kind of holding up their end of the bargain. Certainly, the audience has a share of the blame for embracing, you know, what Chayefsky considers to be kind of, you know, drivel and pablum. But there's also tons of responsibility with the people putting Howard Beale on the air and letting him rant like this. And there are huge problems at the kind of, you know, the corporate executive level of, you know, as we were talking about earlier, this idea of, you know, news being allowed to become entertainment, that it has to serve and fulfill the same function. It just has to get ratings. It has to, you know, generate ad revenue. And then as we learn, you know, kind of even deeper into the film, that there are even bigger superstructures around that driving that kind of chase for profit. There are no nations. There's only the almighty dollar. And so every person in this story has a stake, and everybody has a duty that they're supposed to be fulfilling that they are not living up to in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it really is great. And if you have not read, if you haven't read Dave's book, you should. You just go pick it up. Again, name is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. If you love the movie Network, and again, you should, it's great, great movie. It remains eternally relevant. There's so many fun little stories in here. One of my favorite, just very brief, and this is not even, there's nothing particularly insightful or telling here, was just Ned Beatty talking about trying to remember how to deliver this speech. Cause yeah. it's a long monologue. This is not a short thing. And he kind of came in last minute. He was not the original person who was supposed to play that role, and he nailed it. He gets the Oscar nomination. It's a big win all the way around.
Yeah, just a little bit of trivia, but the actor who was supposed to play that scene is long since passed away, a character actor named Robert Blossom, and what most people probably know him for now is being the old man from Home Alone, the one that Macaulay Culkin is afraid of and then sees in church and realizes he's just a nice old man who doesn't have his family around at Christmas. He was a very good actor as well, but that whole scene would have played much differently. They wanted a kind of big huckster type, and that's how they eventually – Ned Beatty was suggested to Chayefsky and Lumet by Bob Altman, who had just worked with him. And, Beatty had himself, long before he was an actor, had worked as a door-to-door salesman and has this huge presence in that scene, which they filmed at one of the boardrooms at the New York Public Library. And it's just so sort of exquisitely lit. And he's got that long board table in front of him. They wanted to do it at the New York Stock Exchange initially and had permission. And then the Stock Exchange people saw the text of this monologue that Beatty was going to deliver, which is all a massive indictment of capitalism and the interconnectedness of, all of our monetary and economic systems. And they were like, nope, you're not doing that here. But it's kind of a great bit of serendipity that they ended up filming it where they did, because it's just iconic. And that, Beatty standing at the end of that table and just laying into Peter Finch, you have meddled with the forces of nature. I mean, it's, he only has about 5 minutes in the film, but they are, he's giving it his all. And it's like, it really, kind of Shakespearean.
Yeah, there are two supporting performances in this film that got Oscar nominations and one win. I think Beatty won.
Beatty did not, but Beatrice Straight.
Yes,
she won, and she also has about 5 minutes in the film and won. Also, like really, terrific monologue. She's the jilted woman who's on, who gets cheated on. And that's the melodrama, the human side of the story. There's really nothing kind of corporate about it. There's no sort of nothing to do with the sort of the super systems and super structures. That's just like on the speech on this very personal level. But it is, again, there's a lot of like sort of weirdly long monologues in this movie, which is something you don't see that. Screenwriting wasn't even really done that way anymore in 1976. It's definitely not done that way now.
Yeah, no, it's impossible to imagine this movie being made today precisely like this. And it is interesting too, because we were discussing before we started taping that there's this moment in the 1970s where you have what are now kind of thought of as the paranoid thrillers of that time, but they all actually kind of fall into different categories, right? You have the actual paranoid thrillers like 3 Days of the Condor, The Parallax View, but then you also have, movies like this, which is it's a media satire, or you have All the President's Men, which is a political or possibly, you know, news drama, right? It's that, and these all kind of fall into the same moment of this idea that there is somebody out there who is in charge and it is not you.
Yeah.
And that is kind of infinitely adaptable, which is just really, it's again, it's really interesting. And I really feel like we are in a similar moment right now with some of the movies that are coming out, like Eddington, One Battle After Another, Weapons. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, aside from just the weird synchronicity of it.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously, that vibe obviously recurs in cinema. We were talking about, there was like a kind of a period in the 90s, maybe not quite as fertile or as enduring, where you had things like The Firm and The Net and The Pelican Brief. And, you know, in a weird, like, it's kind of too simple to say that a movie like Network is, you know, a kind of post-Watergate Nixonian thing, because, yes, it did come out in 76, but its origins really, I mean, you know, Chomsky was working on it since at least, you know, the late 1960s. So he wasn't kind of writing it with the idea of, you know, at least intentionally paralleling what he saw in contemporary politics. It was just a vibe that he happened to be, you know, tuned into. And it certainly, you know, as filmmakers and studios like to see now, if you, you know, you can succeed if you catch the zeitgeist, if you kind of, you know, reflect back to people what they are thinking of at the time. But it's not necessarily, the screenwriter or the filmmaker is not necessarily, you know, looking out deliberately into the world and trying to say, okay, what can I pull in, or what can I reflect back at them? And I think you could say that also something like One Battle After Another, which, you know, has its genesis in Thomas Pynchon and you know, novel that was, you know, written decades ago, and yet you know, finds a way to be contemporary and relevant again through, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson's reshaping of it. I don't have a great answer as to how, yeah, people like Chomsky kind of catch this early on, but I think it does come from like a deep cynicism, a deep suspicion of authority, and as we were saying before, just this underlying sense that like the bottom's gonna fall out at any moment, and like sometimes culturally that's how a lot of people also feel.
Yeah. So that kind of, let's bring this to today, because I do think, you know, again, you watch this movie and it really does feel like it could be about things that are happening today. I mean, there's, yeah, a whole subplot involving the news network's parent company being bought by an even bigger company, which I certainly don't know any stories like that. At the moment, there's nothing like that's happening right now anywhere in the world of entertainment.
Yeah.
There's another line where Robert Duvall's character says, you know, the FCC could hold this deal up for 20 years if it wanted to, which again is not relevant at all to anything that's happening today. When you look out at the news landscape, what do you see, the news business landscape, what do you see as some of the parallels with Network?
Yeah, it's very interesting because you know, this book originally, you know, I wrote it and it was published, I believe in 2014. And, mm-hmm, you know, at the time, I mean, one thing that I certainly had on my mind and that we were in some ways kind of too early for was the idea of just, you know, television, you know, the power of television combined with anger. If you just put a very angry person on TV all the time and let them vent their spleen, a lot of people are going to catch on to it. And that's what they're going to, you know, what basically whoever television elevates and puts on its screen, people will listen to them and people will tend to believe them. And so in a way, the book was almost premature to kind of catch that idea. But what I knew this was present in the film, and as you're saying right now, I think what we're seeing way more of the sort of the thread of the film that is startlingly relevant right at this moment is this idea of there was supposed to be a firewall between what was news and what was entertainment, between what was information and what was business. And that, you know, the networks, at least for a little while, really kind of treated that as sacrosanct and really tried to protect these ideas. And even, you know, even 50 years ago, you know, Chomsky was concerned, well, what would happen if the people in charge didn't care about this anymore? There's no you know, ironclad law or rule or anything kind of holding this together except the will and the desire of the people in charge. And we're really seeing firsthand what happens when people do not care about that anymore and what the sort of fallout and the effects are that, you know, that that what it's done to that business. I mean, he you know, he would obviously be horrified, but he'd also feel very validated, Chayefsky, to see that his ideas, you know, very much came to pass. And we don't know what's going to come next. We don't, you don't have to sign on to what I'm about to say, but I think that, you know, clearly the TV networks and their news operations are, you know, their validity, their supremacy, their just their people's trust in them is decimated. And I don't see any way that they come back from that. So what follows after that is quite frightening to think about. And that prophecy, I think, unquestionably has been fulfilled.
Yeah, I mean, it's so inextricably, it's so bound to this fracturing of the attention space because of technology. Like, technology has changed things in ways I think people predicted, but also ways nobody could have seen coming. Yeah. I mean,
Chayefsky did not, obviously, you know, he wasn't able to kind of foresee, you know, that just his world was, you know, TV, radio, print media. And if he could have foreseen anything else, he probably would have worked for a tech company and not been a screenwriter. So, you know, that whole aspect, he obviously didn't catch on to, but the sort of the values and the principles that he feels he's trying to uphold, those are still, that conflict is still very much in operation now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is it's so fascinating. I mean, I like, again, it's, you know, some of the numbers being thrown around in this film, you know, I was watching it just this morning, and the idea of a show getting a 40 share or a 50 share, you know, in this day and age, and it's not the Super Bowl. Like, I don't, that does not exist. That's just not a thing that happens.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's crazy just to kind of see, you know, those scenes where Faye Dunaway is like presenting, you know, her you know, programming schedule, and you just see, I mean, first of all, there's no electronics involved. It's like, you know, like a little magnet board or maybe these little placards that she's like sticking on a whiteboard, and it's just like these four columns. It's ABC, NBC, CBS, and this fourth fictional network that they made up. And that's all the television that there is that people have to choose from. And even with just those four entities, it's already sort of, you know, hopelessly complicated. It's already in the dregs. It's already gone to the dogs. And, you know, there's just like, there's so much more still to come, and that there's just going to be this whole kind of deluge of things that are so much worse than, you know, I think Chayefsky could have imagined.
Yeah, it's wild. All right, I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything we should have asked, if there's anything we should be talking about. I mean, there's so much still that you know is relevant here. What did we not discuss that we should have?
It's interesting. I'm almost kind of stumped on this. You know, if I had to think about anything that Chayefsky missed or didn't anticipate, I think in a way, I mean, he was pretty mistrustful of both the youth and the older generations, but maybe more kind of cynical or hard bitten about people who were older because they were presumably supposed to be more knowledgeable in their work, had more life experience, knew the consequences of their decisions, and the world that we're living in, the information landscape that we're in is, you know, falls more at there's more blame to be laid at the feet of people who are younger, people who are kind of fashioning these, platforms and not really thinking through the consequences or not aware of them. And it's very interesting. You know, obviously, a screenwriter like Aaron Sorkin is a disciple of Chayefsky's, and was always very fond of the fact that his movie was called The Social Network, and that it kind of encrypted the word network into the title. But also, I think that what he got right is he was much more attuned to the young characters in his film and their kind of lack of awareness, their lack of experience, their kind of, you know, damn the torpedoes attitude, and let's just invent things and create them and turn them over to people and see what they do with them. He kind of realized how that was going to blow up in everybody's face. Also, that's I think the part of the equation that certainly Chayefsky didn't live through. As we were saying before, he didn't have anywhere near as much technology at his fingertips, but also I think didn't foresee how younger people were also going to be, you know, responsible for, you know, birthing us this, dystopian world that we are now part of.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I don't know. Again, I strongly recommend people watch it. You know, you can rent it on Amazon. You can stream it. I own the Blu-ray. I'm one of those people, so you can watch it on Blu-ray.
Yeah,
and you should.
A lot of times on, like, you know, cross country or international flights, I will see the movie available for streaming, and it kind of cracks me up in a way to see people watching Network on airplanes.
Yeah, comfort viewing for your flight, you know. That's what we do.
Yeah.
All right, Dave, thanks for being on the show today.
Oh,
I really
pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, and just to, you know, it's a book I wrote a while ago, so I apologize if some things about it don't hold up anymore, but it is startling to me how relevant the ideas of the movie and its sort of prophecies, ominous prophecies, really are relevant and really did come to pass, even, you know, all these years later.
Yeah. The name of the book, again, is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. And I have been talking to Dave Itzkoff, its author. Thanks again for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me to do it.
And my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And we'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.